This is The Reason Interview, and I'm your host, Nick Gillespie. Thanks for listening. Over the past four decades, British musician Billy Bragg has carved out a unique position as a modern-day troubadour who takes popular music and politics equally seriously. Early albums such as Talking with the Taxman About Poetry and The International merge concerns with the poor and the powerless while updating and reinvigorating older folk forms with punk sensibilities. At the turn of the century, Bragg partnered with the members of Wilco to release new songs using previously unheard lyrics by Woody Guthrie. The Mermaid Avenue recordings occasioned rave reviews, and in Bragg's own telling, were designed to humanize Guthrie, to transform a left-wing legend back into a real person with physical wants, desires, and needs. For Bragg, like Guthrie, the personal and the political are never really separate. And in August, Billy Bragg released a full-throated polemic against rising populism and free market globalism, which he denounces as neoliberalism. In his new book, The Three Dimensions of Freedom, Bragg writes, "Freedom has been repackaged as the right to choose, but genuine choice in housing, in the workplace, at the ballot box is hard to come by." I sat down to talk with Bragg about British and American politics, Donald Trump, Brexit, and his idea that we need to embrace freedom in what he says are its three dimensions: liberty, equality, and accountability. Apart from strongly supporting free speech, Bragg and I didn't really agree on very much, especially about whether living standards and individual freedom have increased in the 21st century, and whether economic liberalization and globalization have helped the average man and woman. I think they have. He's not so sure, and that's the basis of a very fraught but civil conversation. Billy Bragg, thanks for talking to Reason.
Good to be here, Nick. Thank you for having me.
All right, so you write at one point in your book, and I'm quoting here, "To protect ourselves from encroaching tyranny, we must look beyond a one-dimensional notion of what it means to be free, and by reconnecting liberty to equality and accountability, restore the individual agency engendered by the three dimensions of freedom." There's a lot to unpack there.
There is, yeah.
Let's talk about the one-dimensional notion of freedom. What is the one-dimensional notion of freedom, and why is it not accurate?
Well, I think the idea that freedom is defined as the right of to express your opinion, that's the fundamental freedom that, that libertarianism seems to be, the individual freedom. If that, you know, if the right to say whatever you want to say, whenever you want to say it to, whoever you want to say it to, with no comeback, is the definition of freedom, then look no further than Donald Trump's Twitter feed as an example of what, a shining example of what liberty is. You can see in that that, you know, he's working with absolutely no cognizance of what's actually going on in society, what's going on that day. It's just almost a stream of consciousness that has no relationship often to the social discourse that we're trying to have with each other. So on both levels, how do we deal with a leader who has a tendency, I would argue, towards a soft authoritarianism, but also how do we deal with our online discourse with one another? What parameters do we have to quickly assess if the person that we're dealing with, we've never met, has just popped up in our Twitter feed, is going to talk in good faith or bad faith? And why waste your time talking to someone who's not going to, you know, respond?
Well, and in Trump's case, we have to deal with it because he's the president. But other people, we may not have to.
Online. So I'm trying to both deal with the international, you know, the politics as the way it is, but also the personal discourse on and offer some parameters on how to deal with it.
Okay, so you're not suggesting that the problem is that we're free to express ourselves. It's that if all we're doing is kind of pushing stuff out, you know, that's just not sufficient to make an interesting world.
No, no, of course, because liberty is the bedrock of freedom, obviously, you know. That's and because it empowers you. Yeah, you know, that's absolutely crucial. The right to express your opinion is absolutely crucial. But there is a tendency among, shall we say, the sort of new generation of those who are taking a stand on freedom of speech to act as if that is unassailable, that it's not just free speech they want, it's the right to express their opinion with no comeback. Now, that's not free speech, that's free reign. So, and I think that that is inimical to a free society.
Okay, and when you say with no comeback, what do you mean? That they don't have to deal with, you know, I mean, they block people who speak back?
They, you know,
or what do you mean by that?
They're provocateurs, and when they provoke people, they're upset about it. All of a sudden, you know, they get a reaction, and they're crying censorship. when actually all they're doing is being excluded from a particular forum because they keep causing trouble. Now, if you're a pub landlord in England and some bloke comes in every night and starts a fight, you are completely within your rights to ban that person from your pub.
Right.
Doesn't mean they can't drink alcohol. Doesn't mean they can't drink alcohol in a pub. But you know from your experience that they're causing problems in your space. And I think that kind of proprietal accountability you'd see in the form of, you know, bans from social media. They're not censoring and stopping that person from expressing their opinion, but they are saying to them, these are the rules by which we have our discourse. And if you don't accept and work within these parameters, then you can't take part in this discourse.
So in that sense, then, I mean, if we're talking about social media, you're comfortable with Twitter or Facebook, YouTube banning people or demonetizing them or...
Yeah.
We're saying, look, these are our private platform, or these are platforms we control. And if you're Milo Yiannopoulos, get the fuck out.
Yeah.
You know, if you're going to speak a certain way.
If you're going to continually cause trouble, you're not going to, because, I mean, I'm talking within, I'm trying to create that framework that, that I mentioned earlier, those three dimensions.
Right.
The first one of those would be our liberty, obviously, which is self-empowering. But the second one is equality, which is reciprocal. And that involves respect for the opinions of others, respect in terms of giving them a fair hearing and respect in terms of responding to them in a way that is civil and doesn't attack them, you know, doesn't immediately turn into ad hominem attacks and personal abuse. So we all have that problem on Twitter. So that if you can bring those two together, then you can have the basis for a fair discourse, I think. And unfortunately, the newer generation of free speech warriors don't seem to want to connect with the idea of equality in terms of respect and in terms of recognition.
Who are the people that you're thinking about, or the sites that are not doing that? Because and you know, it's interesting. There's obviously British culture and American culture have not slightly, but significantly different attitudes towards free speech and towards, you know, the First Amendment versus hate speech codes, which are much stronger in Britain. But who are the people who are saying, you know what, I just want to be able to, you know, spew whatever I want without any...
It's not so much they're saying that they want to say whatever they want. They're saying that they are the defenders of free speech. They are the ones who are trying to say truths that are not acceptable. And these people are very often people who have their own YouTube channel. They're filling theaters around the country. You know, they're not
Can
really
we name a name? Who's filling a theater?
Jordan Peterson would be a clear example of someone who feels that his views are unacceptable in some areas.
Right.
The broad group of people defined as the intellectual dark web.
So can I ask, with somebody like Jordan Peterson, he, for instance, he was kicked off, or I guess he wasn't kicked off, but he left Patreon, a platform which allows people to fund, you know, artists or creative people doing stuff. And what he said was, because I believe Patreon had kicked off a couple of other people who were kind of sketchy characters, and he said, I don't like this. I'm taking my money and going elsewhere. I'm taking... Isn't that a good response in the sense of he's not saying Patreon should be forced to carry people that they don't agree with, but I'm going to exit this system and create my own system?
Well, he's right. That's proprietal accountability.
Right.
You know, Patreon have decided that these characters, who I don't know who they were, but I would assume that they're, you know, that there's offensive material, beyond offensive, perhaps abusive. The right to offend, I support the right to offend, I should just say, but abusive material. And Jordan Peterson has the right to act in solidarity with those people. I don't have any problem with that. But what the intellectual dark web don't have the right to do, I think, is to hold themselves up as the only people who are telling the truth, and they're somehow you know, marginalized by the rest of mainstream discourse.
When you're like selling out, you know 15 seat seat arenas, and then you're saying, look at me, I'm a persecuted martyr of free speech. It's not, we're not talking about a legal argument here. It's just that's fucking annoying.
And it is annoying, but you know, these things have always been contested. You know, there is, I would suggest, the struggle to decide who gets to write the rules and who gets to break them with impunity is underpins a lot of this discourse.
So can we talk about it then in slightly different terms? Because it's one thing if we're talking about Twitter and Facebook and YouTube and, you know, kind of platforms that are more or less private, or, you know, have, you know, they're kind of like a
proprietary.
And then what happens when the government starts to get involved? Because, and I'm thinking, you know, if it's the BBC saying you cannot appear on this, or you know, and I'm going to mess it up because I'm not British and my memory isn't as good as it should be, but you know, when the Sex Pistols were topping the charts with God Save the Queen, and you know, the title of the song and their albums were or album was were banned.
Yeah.
That's a categorically different issue, isn't it, than private speech?
It's categorically different because they couldn't have done anything more to make them more popular, to people in my generation by doing that. So that was the best thing about God Save the Queen.
Obviously, whoever said we're not publishing the name of the song was a big Sex Pistols fan.
I wish they would do it to my records, Nick. That would be great for me. I think that accountability works on a number of different levels. It's not a one-size-fits-all.
Right.
First, you have personal accountability, which is where you decide that the person that you're talking to is not worth talking to. So you either ignore them, you might block them, you might hide them. You know, there's lots of ways you can deal with that. Then there's proprietal accountability, which we already talked about, which is if you've got a space or a platform where people are always causing trouble with everybody, you don't need them on there. And then there's state accountability. Mm-hmm. And that kicks in, I think, in cases such as recently in the UK, a man was sent to prison for daubing on the front door of a recently arrived black family, "No blacks here."
Mm-hmm.
Now, I don't think any of your viewers would consider that as free speech.
Right.
That's hate speech. So consequently, he went to prison. There was no, you know, free speech arguments made by anybody outside. So it works on a number of different levels. And I think you have to deal with it in the context. And context is important in deciding free speech things. I think that's always got to be a big consideration, the context in which whatever it was said. And whether or not the person who has then said it has come back and made, you know, put it into context and made people understand that wasn't the intent, or if they've doubled down, and then things change. One of the real problems with social media is that perception always trumps intention. It doesn't matter what you meant. There's always going to be someone out there who sees it in a different way, and you've got to be prepared to articulate what you were saying better, or, you know, apologize and move on. Those people who double down, I think that's where the accusations, be it, you know, abuse, racism, sexism, those stick on people who double down, I believe.
Talk in the book, you discuss safe spaces and people on the intellectual dark web. I think a lot of American libertarians, and I suspect a fair number of British, of the British variety too, mock the idea of safe spaces. You actually mount a defense of safe spaces. What is that defense?
The defense of the safe space is not an attempt to control the subject for debate, but the tone of the debate. The safe space brings equality and accountability into the room alongside liberty and ensures that everybody gets a fair hearing, nobody gets shouted down, and people are held to account for the points that they make. They're not allowed to just, you know, travel roughshod over the assembly, whoever's there. They're the house rules, really. But it's the tone of the debate rather than the things that were allowed to be discussed. And unfortunately, there is an element among the new generation of free speech proponents that is provocative. Milo is a good example of that. He's clearly a provocateur. And he, you know, he's in that way, he's a bit like the Sex Pistols. He's out there to wind people up. And I think if you're a provocateur, you can't be surprised when the BBC ban you if you're trying to wind people up. So in that sense, I think that if you're not prepared to play by the house rules, and the house rules are about behavior rather than how many goals you score, if you can mix my metaphors with soccer there for a moment, I think then that's, you know, that's fair for a university or a debating club to have proprietary accountability.
It was interesting with Milo here, you know, because one of the things that he did in his tour, he would constantly be canceled before he spoke. And then finally, when he got a chance to say what he wanted to say, it was not interesting. And that was part of the reason why his popularity faded.
Yeah, I think his reputation went before him. He was, you know, he seemed to me, the stuff that I read, you know, he was
he is a British. So
he is,
you're
isn't
to
he?
Blame for him.
Oh, yeah,
we are just, you know, the poor colonials
and
dealing with
you fell
another
for it.
British.
You fell for it. You know, no one will put up with him in the UK. That's why he came over here. So he's one of our rejects.
He's like the Beatles.
Oh, heaven for,
don't even get me started.
Finn. No, he's not like the Beatles. He's like the drummer in the Dave Clark Five who no one wants to sit in the van with because he won't shut up.
Well, that's to be a drummer, right?
No.
You always want to be the front man.
You do.
Yeah.
And so did Milo, I think.
Yeah.
But really, it's the ability to have deliberation over these issues. There's far too much polarization in our debates. You know, the current debate in my country around exiting the European Union, Brexit, most of the debate is either no deal or absolutely cancel Brexit. There's no nuance about how we make sense of the almost blank check that the electorate gave the government to say just leave and not tell us how. So consequently, if I can just finish, the problem with that lack of nuance is that if anything will save us from leaving the European Union, which is I would like to happen, it is nuance. It's the nuance of the Good Friday Peace Accord in Northern Ireland. It's the nuance of the border in Ireland. It's the nuance of the lives of 3.1 million European citizens who live and raised families and work in the UK. It's the nuance of our economic relationship with the other 27 nations. To try and have this debate without nuance, to try and have this debate from two extremes, and I think this is reflected in the debate around Donald Trump in this country. The lack of common ground and the lack of, well, really deliberation is damaging, I think, not just to the discourse, but to the social fabric of both our society.
You know, what is driving that polarization and the lack of nuance? So you say social media is part of it because, you know, and I think a lot of people would agree that when you can speak anonymously or you're speaking kind of into the void, bad behavior happens.
Yeah.
People shout worse things, you know, from a crowd than they do in a one-on-one conversation. What are the other factors driving it, though? Because, you know, it's clear it's not just, you know, we get rid of Twitter, we're still going to have a lot of polarization.
Yes. There's a lot of anger out there, Nick. And I think the root of that anger is a lack of agency, a sense of agency among the majority of working people. The forms by which working people used to be able to express their aspirations, by mass membership of labor unions, by having political parties that were candidates of which represented people from the same background as those, some regulation of the way capitalism worked.
Okay, so can we...
All of those things have been stripped away in the last 40 years. And as a result of that, ordinary working people no longer believe that their children will have a better life than them.
Okay.
So they're frustrated. If I'm just finished. So they're frustrated by the lack of agency. And therefore, that anger, they're angry about people that they perceive to be a threat. So immigrants, people on benefits, people who don't agree with them. Because for me, as a democratic socialist, it's only when people have agency over their lives that they feel confident to act collectively. When they feel that there is the possibility of a better future, then they're more likely to work together in the workplace, in the community. You need that sense of agency to give people the confidence to work together, to see the glasses half full, rather than that lack of agency when you're tossed around like a cork in a storm, when you feel the glass is half full and the whole world is against you. That's the situation we find ourselves in at the moment. I think it's because of the economic changes of the last 40 years. And it's manifest on social media because Twitter is like a dark, truthful mirror. We could all move somewhere else and human behavior would repeat itself and those people would come there because they're angry and they're looking for an outlet.
So, you know, part of the book is you talk about Friedrich Hayek in particular in the constitutional liberty, where this is the one-dimensional liberty that you say is lacking. He defined liberty or freedom essentially as freedom from regulation.
I would argue he defines liberty in the book as the right to exploit.
The right to exploit.
To exploit, yeah.
Okay, explain that a little bit.
And
how that plays out in economic terms, because now we've shifted from a conversation about speech to, you know, that's kind of the cultural superstructure, to use Marxist phraseology.
Now we're getting to the economic case. They come together because the social media discourse comes from a lack of agency that's been created by the economic situation that we found
ourselves. Your basic argument is that, you know, Hayek was the, you know, kind of the court economist for Margaret Thatcher.
And Ronald Reagan.
Right. Well, I mean, you know, I'm willing to say in an American context that Thatcher is an epiphenomenon of Margaret Thatcher, that, you know, first you get Thatcher, then you get Reagan, and Hayek kind of is the through line on that.
Well, I think they were coming a long way back. You see Goldwater, Keith Joseph. Margaret Thatcher didn't just happen.
She was
Hayek gave them the parameters around which to find a way forward.
So explain the way, though, that, you know, that that in your view, because this is, you know, the world I'm coming out of, and Hayek has his problems and mistakes, but it's basically what he did was he unshackled the rule of elites and of powerful organizations, governments, big business corporation, and he opened things up to the idea of competition, the idea that the individual mattered more than the group. For me, Hayek is a liberating figure. For you, he is the dark lord. He's the Voldemort, really, of the contemporary moment of alienation.
He undermines the what we refer to in Britain as the post-war consensus,
right,
which is broadly speaking that, you know, we should have a welfare state, we should have free health care, decent, affordable housing, workplace representation.
But that, and can I just ask from, you know, because this is a real treat to be talking to, you know, a maker of the music that I care about, but, you know, he undid the post-war consensus that led us to a point where the Sex Pistols and punk was saying there is no future.
That's true.
So it's like you're blaming Hayek for that post-war consensus that he undid?
No, you have to understand that the Sex Pistols argument of no future was directed at the hippie generation.
Yes.
And their idea of peace and love and everything will be okay.
Right.
I mean, that basically, my generation is the punk generation.
Yeah.
As a 19-year-old, you know, we turned up to the feast, the popular culture feast, to find out everyone was out of their minds on drugs and they were just walking around wearing RAF overcoats and living in squats. There was no future in England's dreaming, which is talking about the creative idea of how popular culture in England expressed itself.
But that's
it also was very economically,
right? I mean,
as well.
Like England was in a doldrums, you know, economically after World War II.
That's true. Because what happened was that Britain, we were Great Britain, went to the IMF to get loans because of the oil shock, went to get some loans, and the IMF said you can only have these loans if you take apart your welfare state. So the idea that greater competition would free the economy for the benefit of everyone has its foundation in those years in
but
the
1970s. But why did it have to? I mean, I don't want to just kind of repeat this, you know, until we get into a fist fight.
No.
Because I'll lose the fist fight.
But we won't go to that.
But I mean, England's economy and the U.S. economy in the West, broadly speaking, by the mid-70s, the economy had kind of gone sideways. It was no longer growing in the right way. There was high unemployment. There was high inflation. And it's Hayek and a bunch of other people who are kind of the villains of your book.
Yes,
are the ones who said we need to try something different than a Keynesian post-war consensus of a lot of government, spending.
At the same time, the gap between the richest and the poorest had narrowed year on year in my country from 1948 onwards, until 1980. Until 1980 when Margaret Thatcher comes to power, and she unleashes the full force of the market. Both in terms of the Big Bang in London, opening up the stock exchange to foreign ownership, and by beginning a process of deindustrialization in our country, which was coming anyway, but could have been done better.
Okay.
The question is, how stringent did that change need to be? Did it really need to be complete deregulation? Did it really need to destroy the unions? Or could there have been a model that they have in Germany where the unions are brought into the boardroom, so that decisions are made in a more consensual way? The problem with Thatcher, and to some extent with Ronald Reagan, and I think this comes from Hayek, is what we call TINA. Your viewers?
There is no alternative.
Margaret Thatcher said, there is no alternative to free market capitalism. That's actually, I hate to say this, Nick, but that's not actually true, mate. You know what I'm saying?
Chinese alternative. You're not providing Xi Jinping.
I'm not. In any sense of the way, but there are other ways of bringing together the economy and a fairer society that doesn't just strip everything away and leave those who are not entrepreneurs outside with no control over their life. The seeds of the situation we find ourselves in now were sown.
So I agree with you that the perception or the feeling, the felt reality that we have no agency over our lives, that drives anger, it drives alienation, it drives nihilism, deaths of despair, sometimes get talked about. I'm not sure, I actually would disagree that that's because of diminution of the welfare state. In the United States, we spend far more money on transfer programs than we did 30 years ago. So it's not clear to me that it's more
the organization in the workplace so that people can bargain for better terms and conditions. It's about the lack of political parties who are willing to offer a different version of capitalism, not abolish it, but offer a different version. I mean, I'm sure Hillary Clinton would have made a fine president, but I worried all the way through the campaign because she was not a change candidate. And people clearly wanted some kind of change.
Trump was clearly more of a change. It seemed to be. I mean, not necessarily a good thing.
No, I would say that actually Trump is a manifestation of a similar impulse to Brexit from a similar place, which is if the system is incapable of offering change and change in a way that has a significant effect on ordinary people's working lives, if the system is unable to deliver that, people will willingly vote for chaos.
Right.
Brexit was a chance to kick Westminster in the pants in my country. And you could see it coming a mile off because in 2010, our electoral system, which is not a great one because it's winner take all. So if you don't elect the local MP, your vote goes in the bin. But the plus side has always been government of whichever shape or form gets a big working majority. For the first time in peacetime, we got no majority. And that's happened again since. The Scottish referendum almost went sideways. The election of Jeremy Corbyn was a rejection of the way things were done in Westminster. You could see a mile off that people were angry with the way that politics was being done
in my country.
So voted against the Westminster idea, which was to remain in the European Union, as much out of spite to Westminster as to
So that faced with a kind of status quo or chaos, people are choosing chaos now.
Yeah, that's my sense, they're trying to, you know, if you've been messed around and your worldview has been turned upside down and you don't feel like this is your country anymore, well, if you want to make David Cameron feel like that, you vote to leave the European Union. So lots of people who we broadly refer to as liberals in their outlook, now they feel like this isn't their country because the country's going to use the European Union. So there is an element of that kind of, you know, we're going to give you a right kick in here.
So you had mentioned earlier that you are pro-Brexit or pro-leaving the European Union,
No.
but not in the context of, of a no deal. What were you, what did I miss there?
I'm in favor of remaining in the European Union. And I hope that we can remain.
Under exactly the same conditions?
No, I think the status quo ante isn't really viable, I think. But the idea of a reformed European Union, remain and reform, which actually was Jeremy Corbyn's campaign
And Corbyn,
line.
You were once spoke very favorably of him. The bloom is off of that rose.
Oh, not really. No, I think he's. You know, I've always had my criticisms of him. I would like him to focus more on things that will actually deliver agency to people, like devolution in England. In England, we have an asymmetrical devolution. The Scots, the Welsh, and the Northern Irish all have their own parliament, all have their own internal electoral systems, which are proportional, whereas we in England, the largest of these nations, you know, 55 million of us, we have nothing except the Westminster parliament, which is not proportional. So I would like to see Corbyn talk more about those kind of things, getting rid of the House of Lords, bringing in a directly elected, indirectly elected second chamber, these kind of things. But economically, he and John McDonnell, I think they're talking about some very, very interesting things.
Talk about the question then of, I mean, because part of when you say people lack agency, there's a sense, and part of your critique, and this is, I think part of your critique of Hayek, is that he leads to policies where multinational global corporations get to call all the shots, regardless, but they don't really have any skin in local parts of England or the U.S. or whatever. The EU seems to be paradigmatic of that, that you have a bureaucracy that is somewhere in Brussels, a city that everybody, even the Belgians, avoid it if they can, but it gets to dictate rules, and it seems to be exactly the type of organization that takes agency away from local people. And puts it into, you know, just as multinational corporations, these people who don't belong to any particular locality.
I don't think that's true at all. Okay. I mean, the only election I get to vote in, you know, there's a local council election, there's the Westminster elections, and there's the European elections. The only the European elections are proportional, so that my vote counts whoever I vote for. And in the processes of the European Union, with the Council of Ministers who are elected by the various national electorates, you've got the commissioners who are like the civil service, and you've got the parliament, and the parliament has to ratify. So it's not as anti-democratic as
as its critics would
say, but it could be more democratic. It could be
More focused. The remain, but
remain reform is to create a Europe that is more focused on people rather than profit. to bring it around to ensure that the levels of workers' rights are uniform right across the union, that companies pay their taxes within the union. I mean, only the European Union is the only people currently taking on Google and Facebook about the issues of tax, and that's genuinely taken on corporate power. So it's paradoxic, like any, huge bureaucracy.
But do you like the idea of the government dictating policies to private companies, saying, you have a right to be forgotten, a lot of the European restrictions on Google and kind of search terms and things like that, does that come loggerheads at all to free expression?
If you went to the bank and you asked to get a loan and an algorithm said no, where's the accountability in that? Is there any bias in the
algorithm? You go to another bank.
Well, yeah, but they're all doing it. The trouble is everything's being put into that that context. At some point, I think there has to be corporate accountability.
Just to structure this along the terms of your book. So the three dimensions of freedom, there's liberty, and we talked about that, and that's kind of freedom of expression, but you're saying that's good, but you have to expect, that's a given. It's a conversation. It's a dialogue, not a monologue.
It's reciprocal because you have to have equality there. But the thing that's interesting about accountability is it is both reciprocal and empowering. It empowers you to hold others to account, but you have to make yourself accountable as well. So it kind of, that's what creates the safe space I'm talking about.
So there's, there's liberty, there's equality, which is that everybody is given a certain, set of access to...
Here's the thing. Outside of the BBC in London, there's a statue of George Orwell. He was a BBC employee. And they've chosen a quote of his to put on the wall. And the quote they've chosen is, if liberty is worth anything, it has to be the right to tell people what they don't want to hear. Mm-hmm. That's not a definition of liberty. That's a definition of license. And I think that's where my sort of like questions around libertarianism come in. Because what that definition does, the right to tell people what they don't want to hear, well, people don't want to hear that 2 + 2 = 5, which comes from Orwell's 1984, of course. And if you only have liberty and equality, that just gives everybody the right to shout 2 + 2 = 5. Where do you have the power to come in and say, no, that's not true, 2 + 2 = 4? And that's why accountability is the most important part of freedom, because it's the bit that gives freedom its teeth. Otherwise, everybody can just say anything they want to say. That's license. What I'm talking about is genuine liberty, where our right is not only protected, but it also allows us to ensure that it's based on fact, on veracity.
Well, who decides that, though, if not...
Who decides 2 + 2 = 4?
Well, yeah.
It does.
But it just does. But it's easy to say that, that's math, but then I want to believe in a certain religion, or I want to believe in a certain way of life. Who are you to say, I want to live with boyfriends. And who are you to say...
That's
2 + 2 = 5.
I wouldn't go into that area at all. But if you wanted to say that the Holocaust didn't happen, for instance, Orwell gives you permission to do that. Orwell's quote gives you permission to do that. That's license.
Right.
Whereas with accountability, you're not able to do that because of historical facts.
So then you...
People don't want to hear that the Holocaust didn't happen. And George Orwell was saying, that's the price of liberty. I don't agree. I agree in the end there have to be facts.
So there is a role for censorship in your articulation of freedom.
Yeah, because there has to be a line where freedom moves beyond the fence into abuse. Mm-hmm. And we have to be able to know where that line is and say, I'm sorry, you're not, that's where accountability kicks in. It doesn't kick in at offense, it kicks in at abuse.
How is that abusive, though, for somebody to rant and say things that are, obviously, or perhaps not obvious to everybody, but obvious to most people are just, not true? I mean, should David Irving, a Brit, who was put in jail, Austria, for denying the Holocaust, which he does, he's an idiot for that.
Yeah.
Does it serve any purpose to put somebody like that in jail?
It does, because I think very soon we'll be in a period where the first-hand experience of what happened in the Holocaust is no longer with us in terms of people being able to give, I was there, and this happened to me. So then it does become an issue of what really happened, as all history does, How do we protect that? Well, there has to be some kind of accountability to say on an issue like that, that it's not a debatable thing, that it did happen, and that it could happen again. If we are to protect ourselves from a repeat of such a thing, we need to be able to keep focused on the fact that this was done by human beings very much like us, and it's not some plot line from a dreadful series of blockbusters or something.
I don't disagree with the idea that you have to keep it alive in order to prevent it from happening again. But I question, and this might be a split between a Brit and an American, that the best way to do that is not through censoring it and then turning people into martyrs or, because they're going to be able to talk, especially given technological innovation, they're going to be able to whisper and keep doing things.
So you're not really censoring them. But so that's the,
Here's the difference. Censorship, not government censorship, but it's through moral opprobrium, through, refusing to engage them in conversation and things like that, and by showing a better alternative history that is actually truthful.
But how do you hold the line on what is truthful and what isn't?
Well, I think it's constantly being negotiated because, are you, the truths that you held to be self-evident when you were 25 may not be when you're 60, right?
Of course. And the internet is always giving you a different perspective. You can find, you can find arguments to back up any point you want to make on this. So it is important that we have some accountability in historical fact with things, because it's quite possible. I mean, I read somewhere the other day that there was a German composer who wrote all the Beatles songs. It was a very interesting article. So it was absolutely crazy, but it was, you kind of read it like that. So I think in the end, this is what you're trying to do is to keep everybody in the same ring around what we're able to discuss. When someone comes in to deny the Holocaust, they are so outside of general consensus of people discussing. You've got to have ways of dealing with them because they're just going to start fights the time.
Do you wonder, and as somebody who's coming at this from a left-wing perspective, do you ever wonder or worry that whatever apparatus you put in place to censor, which would ultimately be a government form, would then be used against
you. Hold to account. Yeah, okay. I am willing to be held to account for my actions, yeah.
And you're not worried that your points of view might be, the next thing that gets turned into like, well, we're not going to allow that to be spoken and you need to go to jail.
I think that the idea of accountability is that everybody knows, that everybody should know where the lines are. Mm-hmm. But we should understand that, each of us. I've been to East Germany. I've been to countries where things are not acceptably said. They're terrible totalitarian places, and I would argue that that kind of thing, if you're speaking the truth and you're being put in prison, that's totalitarianism.
Right.
We'd all be. I'd imagine we're all opposed to that. But yeah, I think what is good for the goose is good for the gander. If I the rights that I demand for myself, I have to respect in those who are talking to me, and both in terms of accountability. It's a two-way street. That's why it's a good thing to use as a point of reference.
Can you kind of translate that into the economic sphere then? Because I think, we can have a robust argument about free speech and the limits of that, and what do you do with people who are clearly provocateurs and might be moving from even just kind of espousing stupid or unpopular points of view to being threatening about it. You know, that's one thing. But then what does economic accountability look like in your kind of anti-Hayekian world, because you're saying that Hayek said, it's the freedom to profit, period,
It's the thing that that Hayek was campaigning all his life against, regulation.
Yeah.
Regulated capitalism is a much better way to approach the way that we do commerce in this country. Those regulations include ensuring all corporations pay their fair whack of tax in the jurisdiction in which they raise the profits so that it can't be disappeared off to a tax haven somewhere. It's
you would agree, though, I mean, for all the talk of like Thatcher or Reagan, it completely got rid of regulation. I mean, the government at the end of Thatcher's years and certainly at the end of Reagan's years spent more as a percentage of GDP than it started. And there's scads of regulations. The financial industry in America is the most regulated part of the part of the economy, really. Yeah. It's like, you can't do anything without filing 50 different pieces of paper. And that just, it doesn't seem to clarify anything. It just creates new incentives to kind of fuck around with people.
Authoritarianism doesn't begin in the middle of the night when people start disappearing. It begins when regulations are so lax that the powerful feel that they can act with impunity. Mm-hmm. And that's why you need to find that balance. As I say in the book, I'm not I've never a revolutionary socialist, I believe that capitalism is like fire. If you tend it and keep your eye on it, it will give you heat and light. But if you let it run free, it will consume everything in its path. So, you know, it needs regulating to ensure that the maximum number of people benefit from it, that everybody has the means by which to realize their full potential. That's my idea of a socialist society.
So, I mean, that sounds a lot like a candidate like Elizabeth Warren in the United States said, I'm a capitalist to my bones. She clearly wants to ramp up regulation, but she fundamentally is not against the profit motive, is not against private property and things like that.
I'm not at all either. But I am against the ridiculous enrichment of some people at the at the top end of the spectrum out of all proportion with their contribution to the business and society in general. I think now that we're aware of the environmental crisis, that corporations also have a liability, a responsibility for what they do, both in terms of the mess they make, but also in the communities that they support as well. And that through organized labor, through democratic socialism, communities would have much greater control over what corporations do, not to stop them from making a profit, but to stop them from fouling the environment, to stop them from moving off somewhere else. You know, look at the AUW, for instance, who are on strike at the moment. They accepted a pay cut so the company would stay there and get back into profit. Now the company's back into profit, they're asking that they get the rewards because they've made a contribution. And that to me is a good example of agency in the workplace. The bosses said to them, look, we've got a real problem here. We're running a loss. We can either move the plant to wherever, or we can work with you and take a pay cut. And the union said, okay, listen, we want to work here. We want to stay here. The community wants us to stay here. We're willing to do that. It succeeded in amazing terms, and it's fair now, don't you think, that the union should sit down and say, okay, then you our slice of the pie in return for that in quid pro quo. Is that fair?
I mean, you know, when you bring up the UAW or the American auto industry, there's a brutal reality of 10 years ago they got a massive government bailout.
Yeah, because capitalism with no regulations doesn't work.
But this
That's
is where,
why they have a bailout.
I would
socialism
argue, no,
for the rich.
Yeah.
Capitalism.
I agree that you know corporate welfare is the bane of everyone's example experience except for the corporations.
But Hayek would be spinning his grave.
He hates corporate. He hated corporate welfare for without doubt. But it's that you know it's in terms of my agency, why the hell would I be bailing out you know General Motors, a company that at its peak of the number of cars it sold in the year it sold the most cars, it lost the most money. It should have gone out of business. And it's taking agency from me to maintain through a wide variety of things, including import tariffs and all of this kind of stuff, you know, a market share that it didn't really earn in a free market to begin with. So, I mean, we can argue this all sorts of
different
ways.
We can. Yeah. Because the reality is if you don't help out companies and they go down, you're left with having to help out their former employees.
And this is also something that Hayek was also supported a basic social safety net.
Yeah.
You know, and I would much rather have that and let businesses come and go in and out of business and we help people who need help at the time that they need it, but not prop up companies that are bad.
But unfortunately, in the model free market capitalism, they do then become companies that are too big to fail, banks that are too big to fail. Well, we've had that situation in 2008.
Again, heavily regulated. If they knew that if they failed, they weren't going to get bailed out, they would have acted differently. I mean, that for me, that's the main takeaway of the economic crisis, is that these banks knew at a certain point that if they got big enough,
UAW. They relied on that book, but you know, didn't work for all of them, did it? Some of them went down.
The smaller ones,
and we're still living with the effects of that, I would argue. Yeah. Imagine if the whole system had gone down.
We'd
have been back in the Depression.
Oh, no, no. Let me ask you this. You said, you know, what you want is a capitalism that works for the majority of people or for most people. What are the metrics that you use to say, okay, we're doing pretty well here now? And I suspect then, you know, if we both agree, and you know this is a standard for a larger conversation that I think is happening, you know, all over the developed world, for sure, is that okay? So we believe in capitalism. We accept that there's going to be levels of regulation, and you know, and transfer distribution of income and things. How do you measure whether or not you know people are doing well or not? Because in the United States, and I really can't speak to Britain, but over the past 30 years. you know, there are more people now living in households in the upper income third than there were 30 or 40 years ago. There are fewer people below the line of poverty and things like that. So it does seem as if the system in a large part is doing well. People's standards of living are going up, but there is unquestionably this feeling that I don't have any control over my life.
So I would say that the metrics would be that someone in their 20s, getting married, should be able to afford a house that's maybe five times their yearly income, get a mortgage and afford a house. Mm-hmm. That people would be able to raise a family on one job.
Why?
Well, because that's how it was when I was a kid. And you know,
but that's just nostalgia.
It's not nostalgia at all. It's a different economic model. No. It's not nostalgia. Okay. It's what exists outside of Tina. If you think there's there is no alternative, then you have to put up with people not being able to afford a mortgage. You have to put up with people having to work three or four jobs. It doesn't have to be that way. The problems with capitalism are systemic. They're not capitalism, not just one. Right. It's not like a element that only works in one way. It's a systemic problem that's come about because people have made decisions, and it is possible to make other decisions that benefit the majority of people, not by tinkering with it, but by taking it apart, putting it together again a different way. That's what Hayek argued. Mm. Taking apart them, you know, his book was all about seeing that the model that we had, the post-war model that we had in certainly in my country, did have elements within it that held the economy in place. And it held the economy in place to prevent people from being out of the reach of being able to buy a house, not able to feed their family on one job. And now we live in the world that Hayek and his disciples created.
Can I ask, so aren't there many more alternatives now? And when you think about it, whether we're talking about social life, cultural life, or economic life, there are many more models. And so, for instance, people, you know, it's common to say, well, the gig economy is horrible. It means that, you know, you're not getting health insurance or something like that, and you have to work a bunch of different jobs. But a lot of people want to be in a gig economy where they are, you know, they're their own kind of labor broker, and they're working this project, and they're living in a particular way. And I owned a house for 25 years. I never want to own a house again. It seems to me we're in a world now where there are so many more options for people that the deregulation of that, the world that we grew up in, is not a bad thing. It's opened up a lot of possibilities.
But where is the power dynamic in that? It's all with the employers. In my country, we have 0 hours contracts. Do you have those in here?
I don't know. No.
0 hours contracts is that you get a job, you're employed, and then you don't have any regular hours. So you wake up in the morning, you get a text, and the employer says, I've got 2 hours work for you today. The next day, you might have 5 hours work. The day after that, you have no hours work. So in the end of a week, you may have only worked 12 hours, and that's all you get paid for. How are you supposed to survive on that? More importantly, how are you supposed to bring up a family on that? All of the power is with the employers. The individual employees have no way.
Not allowed to work elsewhere?
Nope.
Are they not allowed to get other jobs?
Nope.
It's
ridiculous. I mean,
But in the U.S., I mean, in California has just, you know, is basically, and a number of other states are trying to say, if you drive for Uber, you have to be paid as a full-time employee. And that just means like a lot of these jobs are just going to disappear and people are using them as supplemental income. That goes away. Or California passed a law saying if you write more than 35 pieces a year for a particular outlet, you can't be a freelance writer anymore. You have to be a full-time employee. And that just means the freelance market dries up because when you raise the cost of something, you're going to, you know, the demand for it's going to go down.
Well, I think we should pay the real cost of things rather than the Hayekian, you know, let the market decide. I think we need to have standards which deliver to society the ability to give ordinary working people agency. And the agency I'm talking about is the ability to save, to buy a house, the ability to have time with your family because you only have to work one job a week, the ability to be able to live in the capitalist system in a way that gives you some power over your life. I think at the moment, for many people at the lower end of the scale, they don't have that agency. They're pushed around by the hours that they have to work, by the bills they have to pay, and by the circumstances that capitalism can't free them from. They're not able to work their way out of poverty because the system is narrowed to such an extent.
This is a very succinct way of, I think, you know, my understanding is that I don't disagree with you. I want people to be able to flourish. And I think they would do it in a less regulated economy rather than a more regulated economy.
Well, I have to differ than that. I think the power of capitalism is such, particularly corporate capitalism, that it needs to be held accountable for the way it treats its employees.
And I would argue that the corporations are, and this is an argument that could go on for 1,000 years and probably has and will, but that most of the time when you look at that, it's corporations are using the government in order to build certain limits on what's available to people.
Well, the government working with corporations, we call it a mixed economy.
Right.
It's not a terrible thing. We do it in Europe quite well. You know, people thrive in Europe. The safety net as such remains. The ability to support your citizens by mixing with corporate capitalism and regulation.
We certainly have a mixed economy here as well. So let me ask you this, just to end in a discussion of music, okay?
Yeah, sure.
Because this, and it also seems kind of paradigmatic. If there is an industry that has gone through creative destruction more than journalism and media, it's been the music industry over the past 30 or 40 years. From the perspective of a performer, are things better now or are they worse now? And from the perspective of a fan, of a music listener, where do you see things are? And does that come into play at all in the way that you talk about the three dimensions of freedom?
Yes and no. I mean, the thing about music is that it played such a central role to youth culture in the 20th century. It was our social medium. It was the way we spoke to one another, the way we spoke to our parents. It helped you decide what you wore. Helped you decide who you hung out with, who you didn't hang out with. It did all the things that Facebook and Twitter and everything does. So if you wanted someone, me, when I was 19 in Britain, in London, if I wanted people in New York to hear what my opinions were, I really only had one medium open to me, and it was to learn to play the guitar, do gigs, write songs, and hope one day that I'd get a gig here. And fortunately, in 1984, at the Danceteria on 21st Street, I did indeed realize that dream. Now, if you're 19 years old and you feel strongly about a particular issue, you have so many media right there in front of you. You can, obviously on social media platforms, you can make a film on your phone. Mm-hmm. So the focus of music has shifted back towards when it was more about entertainment. Mm. However, there are some things you can't get online, and one of them is the sense of solidarity you get in a gig, the communion of coming together to hear the person who wrote that song that you really, really love and you've invested a lot of emotion in it. And that song that articulates something about you that you can't quite do yourself. You hear that person singing the song. You're singing it. 1,000 other people are singing it. You get sense there that emotion that you've invested is accepted by everyone. You can't get that on Facebook. You're going to probably get an argument before you get there. So, paradoxically, while music is cheap as chips and you can get it for nothing, the experience of actually being in a crowd and feeling that sense of communion, that's much, much harder to come by. So,
Is it harder to come by? Because don't more acts now, the days of, and obviously they were rare to begin with, but the days of the Rolling Stones or the Beatles saying we're not going to tour anymore. Now, because of the change in the economics of the music business, everybody tours because that's how they make money.
It's harder to come by online. Most people experience their culture through a screen. Mm-hmm. That's the predominant experience of that. And you can get everything. You want to see the Rolling Stones live, you can find it on YouTube probably. But what you won't get from that is the atmosphere, the sense of emotional solidarity that you get. So that's why there are more festivals than ever. That's why there are more gigs than ever. That's why I'm able to do 3 nights at the Bowery, which I've never used to be able to do before, because people want that sense of self-expression that comes being in that crowd and all singing along. And I see it, and I can tell it in my crowd. I see it in the faces of my crowd at the gigs. So that's a very human urge that kind of was the original, where the music industry as such was started there. And records really were only made in my country originally to promote gigs. Maybe it's the same in America, I don't know. Maybe this record industry was a blip in a long continuum that goes back into the lost past, and we'll go into the future of people coming together to have an experience, an emotional experience that takes them outside of their daily connection with people. Takes out their individualism and puts them in the collective.
I want to try one last, kind of attack here, like a line of inquiry that might turn you into a Hayekian libertarian, which I realize is a long haul. Yeah. But do you feel as an artist with the kind of breakup of the big record labels in the way that they could really control everything and choke things off in connection with radio stations and either soft or hard legal censorship of the airwaves and things like that, do you feel more empowered to write the songs and release the songs that you want to do?
I wouldn't say more. I mean, I've always felt that.
Yeah.
I think more people have the opportunity to do that now.
So that's a
positive
win.
Thing. Yeah, I agree. Yeah. Because I'm talking now just in terms of purely expressing an opinion.
Right.
Not everybody has it in them to get up on stage in front of people. Some people just the last thing they want to do. Mm-hmm. So obviously, yeah, that's more. But the other side of that is no one is going to, come and pay you three nights in New York to hear you read out your Facebook posts.
Mm-hmm.
That's my sense of it. So ultimately, you do need to find a way to articulate what you're saying in a way that connects with people. That's really the most important thing. And in the end, for someone like myself, who always worked more or less in the indie sector,
mm-hmm.
the big record labels coming or going is neither here or there. What really is missing are those places where everybody congregated, like the John Peel Show.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what's changed in our culture. Digitization has kind of atomized the gathering places. So instead of there only really being one place that played Billy Bragg regularly or the Sex Pistols regularly, which was John Peel, 10 till midnight, everybody who was interested in new music was there, and half the show would be stuff you'd never listen to again.
But that's not such a bad, and I'm not saying it's not a loss, and we still do have kind of central places where things come together, but it's much less than it used to be.
Much less than it used to be. And, so how do you get out of New York? In New York, you can make a splash, mm-hmm. but how do you get to Kansas City and people in Kansas City to know what you're doing and stimulate the need to come there. When you're first
starting,
I've been coming to America for 35 years, probably most year, average twice a year. So that means I've done, 70, 75 tours. But it's still, where the zeitgeist is moves on. And that's why I've written the book, The Three Dimensions of Freedom. If I wrote a song about accountability, it'd be fine. People would sing it at the gig. But if I write a book about it, they put me on NPR. So in order to insert myself into
is one of those last places where a mass number of people go to
and they talk about issues, the same with the BBC in those kind of terms. So it's crucial in terms of not just relying on songs and not just relying on gigs, on trying to get to grips with the discourse. I've always seen my role as an individual who's trying to make sense of the world for himself.
Mm-hmm.
And if that responds to other people, then I'm really pleased about that, because we all see the same stars. It's if you can join them together in an interesting way that gives people a different perspective. And what I'm trying to do with the book is offer a different set of parameters with which to deal with the world. In the 20th century, most of us had an ideology, whatever that ideology was, which gave us a way of looking at issues to work out how we felt about those issues and where we stood on them. We live in a post-ideological world now. The language of Marx doesn't mean mm-hmm. anything to people anymore. As a result of that, we need to find new parameters with which to judge the issues that are in front of us. And I'm hoping to offer up, in terms of liberty, equality, and accountability, a way of working out what's happening in the world, a basis in which to frame any debate, any argument, any person about whether they're working in good faith, and you can, through discourse, direct discourse, learn something from them. Because I think that's the great thing about the internet. It offers us so much information, so much possibility, but bad faith players are constantly undermining our own belief in the information we're getting. And ultimately, I think for those of us who want to make the world a better place, libertarians included, I don't think our enemy is capitalism or socialism or whatever way you come from. Our real enemy is cynicism and our own cynicism, our own sense that nothing's going to change. No one gives a shit about this stuff. What's the point? I don't class I mean, my definition of cynicism is not doubt. Doubt is absolutely crucial. Right. It's the most important of all human vices. Never trust anyone who has no doubts, because they're either a religious fanatic or trying to sell you a Trotskyite newspaper, and neither of them have any sense of humor. I'm not talking about skepticism. You can learn from a skeptic. Right. A cynic to me is someone who's given up, and they want you to give up too, so they make them feel better about how they feel about what they've decided to do. And I don't have time for those people in my life. So being able to detect them quickly and move on, I think that's a useful service to be offering.
All right. Well, we're going to leave it there. We've been talking with Billy Bragg, the musician who has a great new collection that's out on Spotify. The name of that is the...
Billy Bragg at the BBC.
Yeah. And that goes from, what, 1983 up through...
2019.
Yeah. As well as the book that we've been discussing, The Polemic, The Three Dimensions of Freedom. Billy Bragg, thanks for talking.
Thank you, Nick.
This has been The Reason Interview. I've been your host, Nick Gillespie. Please subscribe to us at Spotify, at SoundCloud, at Reason.com, at Apple, at Google, or wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks so much for listening.